Does it deserve a seat on the Human Rights Council? I know that when, if you look at Canada's foreign policy, you'll find that it's, you know, violating human rights, violating international law in so many different ways. So in that sense, no, you know, I think that, you know, there are these international bodies and there's lots of different countries. You can complain about lots of different elements of different countries' policies. And so, you know, I wouldn't take some sort of macro principle Canada should never be on the Security on the Human Rights Council kind of position. But I think that the hypocrisy, the double standards of what, you know, this idea that Canada is a big force for human rights around the world. Well, I'll just take something really simple. The Canadian hub of mining, Canadian mining companies are engaged in abuses in basically every single country in the global south. Human rights violations, ecological damage, and the Canadian state is backing those companies to the hilt and refuses. The Trudeau government promised to bring in some restrictions on that and buckled under the intense lobbying from the mining industry. And, you know, you talk about human rights while you're this like force of like extractivism around the world causing all kinds of destruction.
Who excites you most in the Canadian House of Commons? Eve Engler?
No one. But, you know, I would say Leah Gazan, Matthew Green, Elizabeth May, Nikki Ashton, maybe, but no one is standing up on the big questions around China, Russia, not really.
And the Green Party of Canada versus the NDP. I mean, those who don't know, right? The New Democratic Party in Canada's historic. Can I refer to it as a left of center or progressive party? Began that way. In prairie activism and prairie populism and labor rights, the New Democratic Party, it's come a long way since then. What are your thoughts on the NDP and the Greens as alternatives to the traditional, forget about the conservatives, as alternatives to the liberals?
Yeah, I mean, I've written about, I'm a kind of least bad when it comes to electoral. I'm not going to spend basically any time on electoral campaigns. I think that, you know, there are situations where I would vote for a Liberal MP if it's a way of blocking a Conservative MP. And so it comes down to who has a greater likelihood of winning, right? So I would vote in this by-election taking place in Westmount NDG. I probably would vote for Jonathan, if I live there, I would probably vote for Jonathan Pedneault, because it looks like he's not going to win. It's going to be the Liberals that are going to win, but he's going to be in second place. So I, you know, would probably vote for a Green. I did become a member of the Green Party to support Dimitri Lascaris's campaign, because I thought that was to have an eco-socialist voice was a real, you know, offered some opportunity to sort of break up the dominant political discussion in the country. Similarly, in a previous NDP leadership election, I joined the party to vote for Nikki Ashton. I probably would vote for Elizabeth May if it was in the riding or maybe I'd vote for, because she was almost certainly to win. But if it's a close vote, I would probably, you know, vote for the Green candidate, depending on the riding. In the macro, I would say I see the Green Party's policies as a little bit better than the NDP's, but it's pretty similar.
What gives you hope? It's the famous last question, Eve Engler. What gives you hope as you cast your jaundiced eyes on Canadian politics and global politics and the fate of the earth today?
I mean, if the enslaved of Saint-Domingue could rise up against the absolute shocking horrors of the French colonial barbaric slave economy, and over 13 years defeat the French, the British, the Spanish with support from the US, and deliver a massive blow to white supremacy, to slavery, basically begin the whole process of ending slavery around the world, and set up an independent country. Certainly the obstacles to change today are much less than the people who had been stolen from Africa and forced into a brutal plantation economy. So we can do it. We've done it. There are improvements in my lifetime. I've seen improvements on some, you know, important issues. I've seen some climate, all the ecological issues generally going in the wrong way. But, you know, it's mobilization, it's people being engaged. That's what gives us hope.
But the global economy really is based on permanent war and preparing for war and projecting power so that war can be waged. This is what the, you know, all of the leading global economies are engaged in, certainly the United States and Canada.
And it's an obstacle, you know, the dealing with the climate crisis and related ecological crises requires international solidarity. It requires a sense of seeing ourselves as a collective humanity. If we can't, and whereas militarism and the nationalism associated with it is just an obvious obstacle to that. If we can't see ourselves as sort of inherently equal and you know, as a collective humanity, then the ability to deal with these, you know, great crises is very, very, it's already difficult. It's that much more difficult. So we need to challenge militarism and this sort of logic of empire and domination that's associated with it to deal with so many of the important social and ecological issues.
Yves Engler is a Montreal-based writer and political activist. His 2009 book, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, was shortlisted for the Quebec Writers Federation Mavis Gallant Prize for Nonfiction. Yves Engler's most recent work, Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military, was co-published last year by Black Rose Books and Red Publishing. We'll link to Yves Engler's works at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. For as little as $5 a month, you'll be helping to make this weekly news package happen. One of the world's longest-ruling strongmen finally stepped aside, handing power to his son. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen has had a long, colorful career. During the Cambodian Civil War between 1975 and 79, he served as a commander for the genocidal Khmer Rouge. Following his defection to Vietnam and the downfall of the Khmer Rouge, Hun Sen became Cambodia's foreign minister, then prime minister, in 1983. 40 years later, Hun Sen has handed the position over to his son, Hun Manet. The transfer was rubber-stamped by Cambodia's parliament, controlled by the Cambodian People's Party that Hun Sen continues to lead. Not much is known about Hun Sen's son, Hun Manet. Since graduating from West Point Military Academy, he's been Cambodia's counter-terrorism chief and a deputy military commander. Western observers wonder if he'll govern with a more liberal touch than his father, and whether Cambodian relations with China will continue to prosper. Washington is upset by Chinese plans to help develop Cambodia's naval base in Rheims on the Gulf of Thailand. The fate of mangrove forests up the coast from Rheims is likely not on the Biden administration's radar. Coastal mangroves are threatened all around the world. In Cambodia, they've been cut down for charcoal and replaced by shrimp farms. Cambodian military chiefs and their rich clients have had a hand in this and in lucrative forestry operations to the north. Here's a story about that. The bustling town of Koh Kung on the southern coast of Cambodia. Beyond the hubbub lies one of the most pristine mangrove forests in all of Southeast Asia. I head out in a motorboat in the company of three Cambodians who've been helping mangrove villages to protect their unique forest ecosystem.
We try to build up a federation, community federation, for resolving the community conflict. How they have the same fishing ground. Now we build a free community in the community federation. Yeah.
This is Fiset from Cambodia's Ministry of Environment. A half hour from Koh Kung, across the tranquil waters of Trau Pross Bay, our boat comes to a halt. The bay is shallow, and I can see grass growing on the bottom.
Some snails, long snails.
Kim Mum Heng works with Canada's International Development Research Center, which helped launch mangrove protection here in Koh Kung province.
You can see seagrass very clearly and some small aquatic life there.
Healthy seagrass beds protect more than just fish, says Ratana, Visat's partner from the Ministry of Environment.
If we protect the seagrass, seagrass grow very well. The poor people catch a lot of fish inside the seagrass areas.
Like the mangrove forests around us, seagrass is endangered. Pushnet fishing rips them up. Encouraged by the IDRC and United Nations Development Program, the villages of Trau Pross Bay have made this seagrass bed a protected area. We head off to Koh Sralau, a village deep in the mangroves.
Now we arrive at Koh Sralau community. It is our pilot project.
Our boat pulls up at a jetty on stilts. I climb up a steep ladder. Three men in olive uniforms and floppy hats smile as we walk down the jetty to the shore. Hello! These are community rangers, key players in the region's participatory mangrove management resource project.
These environmental rangers get the capacity building for environmental protection and education.
Past a pigsty and a warren of alleyways, Koh Sralau villagers are waiting to meet us. Nearby, a large sign has been planted in the ground. What does the sign say?
The large people, it depend on the natural resource in the sea. So they appeal to all people to protect the area.
And there's various pictures of sea life on the bottom. There's a crab and lobster and a squid and various species of fish and a dolphin. The sign has been erected by Koh Sralau's Village Management Committee. Their mandate, to protect local mangroves, which are a source of village livelihoods. Villages like Koh Sralau are saving the mangroves from destruction. After the fall of the Khmer Rouge and two decades of ensuing conflict, Cambodia's rich and powerful cashed in on peace by turning mangroves into shrimp farms and shipping their trees to Thailand for charcoal production. Impoverished Cambodians flocked to Koh Kung to earn a living from the fish and crabs so abundant here.
In 2002,
encouraged by overseas NGOs, the Cambodian government cracked down on the destruction and invited mangrove communities to manage their own resources sustainably. Four village management committees have been established within the boundaries of wildlife sanctuary. Koh Sralau is one of these. Their biggest job is teaching villagers how mangroves work and why they should be conserved.
They are invited to attend a workshop so they get understanding about the benefit
of the mangrove, and they disseminate the information or educate other people.
Environmental education has paid off. Coast Relau has replanted mangroves and put a stop to cyanide and dynamite fishing. But the learning process never ends.
Some people do not know the benefit of mangrove. They do not know that in the area there are different types of species. She mentioned it around 30 species.
Of mangrove.
Of mangrove. So the benefit is very huge. But for the local people, they live from hand to mouth. They think about getting money, enough money for today. They do not think about the future.
And fishing laws must be enforced with limited resources and inconsistent government support.
They have clearly a policy or law, and they should, you know, making decision strongly to stop all these people, I think.
We go for a ride through the backwaters of Trau Pross Bay, putting slowly down languid channels flanked by mangrove forests. Here and there, villagers in small boats cast their nets into shaded waters. We sit quietly in a pond where the mangroves are being regenerated. Stocky trees perch on spider-like roots above glistening banks of mud.
This mangrove is the first replanted by IDRC project about 2 or 4 years ago.
Mangrove forests are among the most diverse ecosystems in the world. Birds and monkeys hang out in their canopy. Fish, crabs, mollusks, and turtles hide and spawn in their tangled roots. The mangrove root system holds soil in place, protecting the coastline from storm surges. Ratanov, Fiset, Hang, and I head out to another mangrove community.
The community is Kokapi. It is the area that we have worked with the community for a long time. It's similar after the Kofalai community.
This is Kokapik, a charming collection of houses on stilts.
It is the house of the village management committee chief. She's a woman.
What's so special about these mangroves, I ask the committee chief.
A special benefit of the mangrove is the diversity of the aquatic animal, including shrimp, fish, crab that live in the forest, a mangrove forest.
But the richness of these mangroves makes them a target for unscrupulous outsiders and local villagers hungry for cash.
The lifeboat is the big fishing boat, you know, that they bring from Thailand. And this light make the shrimp or crab or fish, you know, get closely. They're happy to play with the light, and then they use the net to collect all of the resources.
As we're leaving, a young man introduces himself. This is Sokyun, the village chief's son. Some people reckon there's cash to be made by cutting down mangroves, Sokyun says. But the people of Kokapik can earn more by conserving them.
In the future, we will make a project about the tourists in this village too. But we don't know where to inform to advertising to the tourists. Anyway, we have low budget, low money to operate this project.
Money is scarce, but Sokyun's got plenty of ideas and a degree in tourism from the University of Phnom Penh.
I think only one tourist bring $100 per week. 10 tourists come and bring $1,000 per week. So per month, the income in this community will be $4,000 per week. It's very high.
Once tourists start coming, Sokyun says, villagers will see the light.
When the tourists come, they will know about the income from the mangrove to protect and go. Mangrove will make the income for them. So they will protect the mangrove rather than destroy.
Not far from Kokapik, outside the boundaries of the wildlife sanctuary, We survey the fruit of those who'd rather destroy than protect. Before us lies a huge clear cut. All that's left of the mangroves is a swath of black mud baking in the sun. Who are these rich, powerful people who are destroying the mangroves? I ask Ratana.
Some military and some the government officials. They clear the mangrove for a shrimp farm. And after that, you know, they clear more mangrove for their own property.
Across the bay from this desolate scene, Kokung's mangroves face their greatest threat, one that's just begun to play itself out. Sand is being dredged from Kokung River for sale across Southeast Asia. The mangroves seem to be suffering. Read more about Cambodia's mangrove forests at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and the Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Hey, SFU! Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Return It will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.